So good afternoon. This is State Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division, and I'm calling the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division to order. I want to welcome members and staff, as well as members of the public who are joining us on the House website, on YouTube, and on Facebook Live. This is our first meeting as a committee under the new House Rule 10.01, which allows for remote committee hearings. Please forgive us. There may be a few technological bumps. And as we do more of these, presumably the process is going to get a little smoother. So I am going to start with a few notes for members and also for members of the public. In order to preserve our sound quality for this meeting, it's going to be really important for people not speaking to keep their microphones muted. Right now and during our presentations, staff is going to be muting everyone's microphones. And then at other points, for those who are not speaking, at other points, we'll be unmuting the microphones, such as when we're voting. But even then, I'm going to ask members and presenters to keep themselves muted, except for when they intend to speak. And again, that's going to keep our video and our audio intelligible. I'm to confirm all the committee discussion will continue to go through the chair and questions as well. To request recognition, members, just a reminder that there's the raise hands feature in the Zoom interface. You'll want to use that. If you're dialed in, you can raise your hand by pressing *9. And if you're having any trouble with this, you can simply email our committee staff, Alyssa Fritz or Polly Cirkvenic. A reminder that members have received a packet of our meeting materials via email. And for members of the public who are watching this, those materials are also posted online at our committee website. For the Early Childhood Division. I'll note that among other things, the materials include a PDF of written testimony from a number of providers and parents. And speaking of which, if other members of the public wish to submit a written comment or question, you can please email it to our committee administrator, Alyssa Fritz, and her email address is alyssa.fritz@house.mn. That's alyssa.fritz@house.mn. alyssa.fritz@house.mn. And then finally, a note about our schedule today. Because House Public Information can only broadcast two committees at a time in this format, and because we have many committees trying to meet, we are under severe time constraints. So today we're going to have to end a few minutes early, a little bit early, in order to accommodate another committee hearing, a video switch over to that that will start at 4 p.m. So that's all the process stuff. Any questions from members about any of this? And of course, there'll be other opportunities along the way. To remind you, hit the raise hand button. So I'll give just a few seconds if we have questions about that. Any of our procedures. And I'm not seeing anything so far, and I'll continue to keep my eyes peeled. So with that, we're going to start as usual with a roll call, and I'm asking the microphones again be unmuted, though continue to suggest that if you're not speaking, keep your own microphone muted when you're not talking. And once the microphones are unmuted, then I'm going to ask the clerk to please take the roll. So I believe they are unmuted. We're going to give this a try. So would the clerk please take the roll?
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katiza Watoon, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bonner.
Present.
Representative Damath.
Present.
Representative Heinzman.
I'm here.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Wasilewicz.
Present.
Representative West.
Here.
So a quorum is present, and our next order of business is to adopt the minutes from our most recent meeting. And again, a copy of those minutes is in the virtual meeting packet that's posted online and emailed to members. May I have a motion to approve the minutes? We'll see how this goes.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I think I saw the Vice Chair, Representative Katiza Watoon. We'll go with her. So Representative Katiza Watoon moves adoption of the minutes of our March 12th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections from any members? So seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
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 And any opposed? Okay, the motion passes and the minutes are adopted. And so now we're going to pause for staff to remute the microphones. And again, members, if you do have questions along the way, just hit the raise hand button. We are going to move to the heart of today's informational hearing. And just a few kind of opening thoughts to set the stage here. It seems to me it should be clear to everybody by now that childcare is the backbone of our response to the pandemic. Every other vital sector, healthcare, the groceries, utilities, they all depend on that. And as members of our committee know really well, this was a sector, early care and learning, that was in crisis even before the pandemic. And now I've heard from many providers, I assume that you have too, that this new crisis on top of the old crisis is putting many on the brink of closure. And so today, it seemed to me to be really useful to explore this from several perspectives in the limited time we have to get a sense as to what's going on with this and shine a light on it and increase our own understanding. And so we're going to be starting with a discussion, a presentation from First Children's Finance. And so I'm going to ask our testifier, Ms. Pearl, to have her line be unmuted. And if you can please identify yourself for the record and then please share your testimony with us.
Hello. My name is Suzanne Pearl. I'm the Minnesota Director for First Children's Finance.
And please proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Great. Chair Pinto, representatives, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. As I said, I'm the Minnesota Director for First Children's Finance, a Minnesota-based nonprofit and community development financial institution whose mission is to build the supply and financial sustainability of excellent childcare. For 30 years, we have focused on the business side of childcare, and never has that focus been more important than it is now. The business of childcare, and make no mistake, it is a business, has always been complicated. There is a delicate balance between profitability, accessibility, and quality. Unlike most businesses, the market for childcare, if that market is defined as working families, which I'll get back to, cannot sustain the cost of delivering childcare. For example, for childcare centers, labor is normally 70% of their fixed costs, often and usually at low pay, with another 20% for facilities, leaving little for anything else, including program, curriculum, much less profit. Family providers face similarly slim margins. On average in Minnesota, after expenses, family providers report revenue that equates to less than $25,000 a year salary. Given the long hours required of family providers, 49% of providers make less than $8 an hour before taxes. In greater Minnesota, that average is closer to $6.50 an hour. With margins like these, childcare businesses have to be strategic about enrollment to maximize their revenue. They need to balance how many kids at what age they can serve, along with consideration about how much parents can afford to pay. Any shift in enrollment impacts the feasibility of the entire business entity. Providers constantly juggle birthdays when kids are aging into different categories, staffing ratios, supply costs, scholarship reimbursement rates. The result is long hours and little profit for providers and not enough available childcare for working families. 2 months ago, childcare in Minnesota was already in crisis, and now we're in a pandemic. We have heard from hundreds of providers in Minnesota who are worried about whether they can or even should stay in business. Those who remain open report huge drops in enrollment, often to as low as 20 to 25%. Many providers require families to pay when their kids are taken out due to illness to retain that childcare slot, but those providers are really struggling with enforcing those policy because they know these families and that many parents are struggling themselves due to layoffs or furloughs. So providers lose revenue even while they try to stay open for the families who still need them. Along with loss of revenue due to decreased enrollment, providers have shared their concerns about access to supplies, particularly cleaning supplies. And often when they're able to find what they need, it's at a higher cost. Concern for their own health and the health of their staff, particularly those who are serving children and healthcare workers, and especially when they can't procure cleaning supplies or PPE. Having to lay off staff and concern about their ability to rehire those staff later. Earlier I mentioned the low pay of childcare workers. The current situation has really brought that to light as childcare workers who have been laid off and access unemployment insurance are often being paid more not to work than they were at their jobs. We've heard from center directors whose staff are asking them to close or lay them off so they can apply for unemployment insurance. There's also difficulty in accessing SBA PPP emergency funding before it ran out. Historically, childcare providers haven't done well in qualifying for SBA loans due to their business model and tough financial position. we aren't optimistic that enough providers will be able to access those funds now, even if there is another stimulus package. With all of these factors, I can't stress enough the adverse impact that the current situation is having on childcare providers who want to stay open, who've been asked to stay open, and are often exposing themselves and often their homes and their families to serve kids of essential workers. Providers have been talked about and been talked to, but many don't feel that they have been heard. Their income has dropped off a cliff. One provider told us that instead of being paid to provide childcare, she is actually paying to provide childcare. Another provider said she hears providers being referred to as heroes, but she feels like they're treated more like hostages, that they need to stay open for business, but can't get paid and can't access capital. And that's the issue. Working capital. Any business needs it, and right now, childcare businesses need it more than ever. Minnesota recognized this early on in the pandemic and has been a national leader on financial support to childcare providers. I want to acknowledge with gratitude the efforts already made by the state through peacetime emergency grants, as well as grants made through our partners at the MIFS and Think Small. Providers are grateful as well. But with gratitude and respect for what has already been done, it's not enough. None of us know what the next 3 months, 6, 12, 18 months holds. We are currently in a public health crisis as well as an economic crisis. We can try to look past the public health crisis towards an economic recovery, but it's more likely that we're looking at cycles or waves of schools, restaurants, businesses opening and closing, which means that childcare needs to be able to flex along with those cycles. In order to do that, childcare businesses need capital to sustain when enrollment is low and to build back up when enrollment moves higher. Providers need flexible capital in the form of grants, loans, forgivable loans, strategically targeted around the state where the need is greatest. They also need guidance on how to leverage that capital. Most childcare providers are really small businesses. They don't have a CFO or a marketing department. They need help to strategically deploy that capital and put it to the best use during the economic crisis and preserve childcare availability for when it's needed. If there's any positive from all of this, it's an overdue, wider recognition of the critical role that childcare plays in our society and our economy. Earlier, I mentioned the market for childcare and whether we should consider working parents as comprising that market. The reality is that the market is not just working families. It's businesses who need to hire employees from those working families who need childcare. It's communities who need strong businesses who need employees who need childcare. And finally, it's the entire state of Minnesota. We all need thriving communities who in turn need strong businesses who in turn need employees from working families who need childcare. Childcare puts people to work. Thank you for your time. I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you sharing that, Ms. Pearl. And members, just a, sort of a process check here. Ms. Pearl is available. I think you're available for the next little while, Ms. Mm-hmm. Pearl. But then my understanding is that you need to leave by 3 p.m. is my understanding. I'm seeing you nodding. And so we'll have a discussion with Ms. Pearl now, and then we'll kind of go through the other presenters and have questions for them at the end. But if there are questions or discussions for Ms. Pearl while we have her, we can do that. So we're going to see if folks have anything. Maybe while you're considering whether to raise your hand, I'll just make a note that we heard from First Children's Finance. They presented to us in St. Cloud at our hearing last spring with the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. Then again in Winona in the fall with that same committee where we had the joint hearing. And now we're getting to hear the perspective during the pandemic. But I guess the things that I heard felt very connected with what we had heard along the way in those prior presentations regarding the work that's happening and the need all around the state. So I'll just see if there are questions or otherwise. Representative Pryor, I've got her on the list, and I'll look and see others. Representative Pryor. And it may take us a minute to do the unmuting and get everybody be available. So we're going to work on it.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. So I'm using my phone as my audio for this. And the question that I have is for a testifier, since the start of the pandemic, it sounds like you've been getting lots of information, lots of data from our child care preventers, providers across the state. Have you been doing that in a systematic way, or is that just that people are in contact with you and because they're reaching out and want their story heard? How is this happening, and how are you getting the feedback on where our providers are right now?
Ms. Pearl.
Sure. Thank you for that question. We pretty quickly started reaching out to providers. We have staff all around the state, one in each of the MIF regions, to put it that way, and two Twin Cities. And we asked them to call providers who they were currently working with, many of whom we're working with through our Rural Child Care Innovation Program. We have not done any sort of survey or more large scale canvassing. We're very aware that there's a little bit of survey fatigue among providers. Mm-hmm. They're getting asked a lot about how they're doing. So that was our outreach. We have probably heard back from about 150, maybe a little more, through that effort.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the reminder. Sorry about that. Our next question was going to come from Representative Heintzman. We can unmute him, and I'll try to keep a closer eye on my own microphone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if there was a specific issue or concern that the testifier was hoping that this committee would address.
Ms. Pearl.
Thanks for the question. Probably my message is that gratitude for the financial assistance that has been provided through different channels from the state to child care providers. But the economic forecast for child care right now is dire. Businesses are in danger of having to shut down permanently. We could lose our child care system without further financial support.
And I'll just note, Representative Heintzman, that was a lot of purpose inviting Ms. Pearl in and getting the perspective of First Children's Finance, is that they have a statewide perspective. I'm kind of on the inside business workings of providers, and I have been hearing that very same message about the situation being very dire, that we're in danger of losing an entire industry. And so it seemed really helpful to get the perspective and that insight so that we have the information to draw upon. But Representative Heintzman, back to you.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to figure out, what there might be, if there's more that we're supposed to be doing, or if there's adjustments that need to be made, or some of the comments that maybe we might be getting from other parts of industry, suggestions otherwise. Just was feeling that out a little bit.
No, I appreciate it. And Ms. Pearl, before I go to the next question, if you have other things, just to confirm, the idea of this hearing is in fact to get that perspective and those ideas. And so certainly, Ms. Pearl, as you have those thoughts, please share them, and we'll certainly be encouraging our remaining providers as well, our remaining presenters, pardon me, as well. Maybe Ms. Pearl, what I'll do is move to our next questioner, but then have you certainly feed in anything more that you want in terms of giving. We appreciate the gratitude. What we really want to know is what is needed to help this industry to be able to help the rest of our state. At least that's my perspective. But Representative Franson is next, and so we can unmute her.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Ms. Pearl, for speaking to us today. I can appreciate the concern out there. As a former child care provider myself, I went through the housing crash of 2008, 2009, and it was a stressful time. And the banks got bailed out, right? And it was me, the childcare provider, asking where my bailout was going to be because we had families that were leaving and unable to stay in childcare because they had lost their job, or I had a family, he's now back, but they left for Nebraska looking for work. And it was a time that I'll never forget. And any family you had in your home was a blessing because that was at least a bill that you could pay. So my heart is definitely with those providers right now. On the other hand, they are actually one of the fortunate businesses to be able to be open, right? To be considered essential, so to speak. And this dichotomy right now where, yes, they are hanging on a thin thread, that needs to be recognized. I recognize that. But they are not the only industry that is in dire straits right now that is on the brink of closing. We do have businesses that are actually permanently closing. They will never open up. We have individuals that will not have a job when the economy does open up. And so it's not just childcare providers. I want that on the record, that we recognize that it's the entire economy that is on the brink of collapse right now. Do the childcare providers, do they have access to the emergency small business loans? And should they be a part of any potential micro business loan program? You know, the federal government put through their CARES Act some funding, which has now been depleted. I've been informed about that. Hopefully Congress can put apart their partisanship and focus on the best, what's for on the greater good for all of us here. But is that something that we should look at? Could you just fill us in on that, Ms. Pearl?
Ms. Pearl.
Thank you for the question. It's a great question. Historically, childcare has not been very successful in accessing SBA loans. Those loans are, they're not coming directly from the feds. They're going through other banks. And when banks look at childcare financing, they get really skittish. And it's difficult to say now whether the more funding being pushed through that system, what the criteria are, whether that's loosened up. I've heard of exactly 6 childcare providers who have been able to access either SBA or PPP funding in the last 2 days. That's not many, but again, it's hard to know whether that is a volume issue or a childcare specific issue. I think we don't have enough data yet. I do know that when we are referring childcare providers to, because that's what we're telling them to do, go sign up, go sign on, see if you can go. The system and the forms, they get really nervous and they're not used to, that sort of federal banking format. So we're trying to help them get through that. But I think there is just a threshold issue with providers being able to put all that together. I had somebody heard of a provider who was not eligible because they don't have a business checking account. They're just using their regular checking account. So that disqualified them. So there are issues like that that are real endemic to very tiny little micro businesses, which is what these are, trying to access that system.
Mm-hmm. Representative Franson.
Yeah, so another concern, Mr. Chair, and probably Ms. Pearl, you've heard of, is the unemployment system right now. Thankfully, we have it, right? And the federal government has kicked in some extra funding there. But I am being contacted by centers and other employers that, due to the benefit from the federal, that there's more of an incentive right now not to work. And what do you have ideas? Like this one provider emailed probably all of us on the committee wanting an additional $600 so that they can keep their employees on payroll, right? Well, we don't really have funding right now. I don't believe the chair has a target. If there is a target, it's probably going to be a negative target. What do you think, Ms. Pearl, we can do in this situation here?
Ms. Pearl.
Yeah, that is definitely something we're hearing as well. And, you know, where a center lays off, you know, maybe 50% of their staff, and those 50% are now taking in more than they were when they were working, and the staff who are still working are working hard and potentially exposing themselves to the virus. I have heard other partners talk about some sort of hazard pay for people who are, you know, staying at work, if that is something that is viable. You guys know how much money you have. But something like that would kind of even out the incentives would be.
Yeah, and so that.
Representative Franson.
Oh, thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair, just learning this whole thing now. Yeah, that the email that I received was advocating for a $600 hazard pay. I'm just interested in knowing where that actually came from, that idea. So what worries me is that these individuals, like sometimes it's an organization that puts this forward and says, here, email your lawmaker and request this, right? Which we have no money. We have to be realistic that we are heading into a major deficit. There's going to be major decisions that are made in the next budget cycle. So if there's organizations that are sending out these requests and say, email your lawmakers, I think that fills the business owner with a false hope that there is something out there. And then that hopelessness can to lead to despair. I want everybody, I think it behooves us all to be realistic in the requests that are being made right now of lawmakers and of the budget as well. Otherwise, it does a disservice to the individuals that are asking for help, because there may not be, and it also does a disservice to the lawmaker having to be realistic with the person that's emailing us.
And I will say, I'm not aware of an organized effort towards that in Minnesota, Representative Franson. I do know that other states are providing hazard pay. I know North Carolina is one of them, but I'm not aware of an effort to drive that in terms of that. But yeah, Ms. Pearl, any comment you have on any of that? I do know that you made the references in your own testimony to some of the differentials Representative Franson referenced. But please, Ms. Pearl.
Yeah. Our, you know, where we're coming from is that differential and how hard it is for providers to try to stay in business with the incentives as they are. I would say, as far as being realistic about all this, our job is to work with providers and have them be as realistic as possible about their finances. We're not trying to fill anybody with false hope, because there really isn't much right now. So our business consulting is really in, this is the situation that you're in.
And Ms. Pearl, can you give us a sense, and I know that you go very shortly here, but just, I mean, if we continue on the path, what are we looking at in, you know, whether it's a month, I mean, some time frame here for childcare being available for essential workers? Yeah, please. Yeah.
Sorry about that. We're early on in whatever this is. We are just, right, you know, what, 1 month in. And I think Ann McCauley is going to talk more about the peacetime emergency grants. But the number of applications they received and what they're going to be able to do means that next week, a lot of providers who were hoping for some help are going to get a hard no. And I think you'll see a lot more childcare businesses close, and that in turn is going to make it more difficult for whenever we are able to start putting people back to work, we're going to have to start from scratch then with, you know, building back childcare supply. The point that we're trying to make is what can we sustain so we don't have to start over as we go through what is likely to be an up and down cycle of opening and closing. We just don't know what this is going to be.
Yeah. Okay. I know that you need to go. We're going to have to move another test. I do want, in case there's, if there's any more, Representative Franson, I had to send you probably wrapped it up unless there's anything quick. So I guess we'll then move on. Thank you so much, Ms. Pearl. I know that you need to go. It's actually a nice transition to our next testifier, Sergeant Peterson, with the Pequot Lakes Police Department. And so we can unmute her and bring her up, or make sure that she's okay, and available. And reminder to members, I think we'll be muting everyone along the way. Sergeant Peterson is someone that we definitely want to make sure has childcare available, of course. I want to highlight that she was honored by the city council and her community with a Lifesaver Award late last year for helping to save the life of a woman who was having a heart attack in a vehicle that was pulled over. So just when we think about what happens if we do end up losing childcare, and it's true so many other industries are in trouble, this is one industry where if this doesn't exist, then lots of other businesses don't as well, and people and other jobs don't, including this one. So Sergeant Peterson, if you can just share, we have just a couple minutes scheduled for you, and please share your perspective.
Thanks, Chair Pinto and all the representatives. I'm Sergeant Kate Peterson. I work for the Pequot Lakes Police Department. I have been with the department for 14 years. I am also on the fire department as the safety officer, and I am the state secretary for the Minnesota Fraternal Order of Police and the president of our Fire Relief Association. So I'm busy. I have a almost three-year-old, and childcare is extremely important. And I'll go with what my job entails. Right now I oversee three full-time officers, five part-time officers, and five reserves. We've got a small department, but it's a small community. Law enforcement is crucial at any time, keeping the community safe, but it's more so than ever right now. We have numerous people that are, you know, panicked, you know, uninformed, reading things online and thinking that they're true, wanting to know what to do and coming to us. We've got, you know, that stress on top of our personal stresses. And right now, I think our biggest stress in our department is, one, we don't have the proper supply for PPE, or enough of it. And out of the four officers that work underneath the chief, all of us have kids. And all of us have a other half that is also an essential worker. I don't know what it is. Police officers seem to like nurses and things like that. So my daughter, Lauren, goes to a daycare in Pequot Lakes. And before you guys had passed that recent bill to help the daycares, I actually was communicating with Representative Heitzman about that. And when it was passed on Thursday, I was really excited. Sunday morning, I woke up to a text message from my daycare provider saying, we have 1 week left and we are closing our doors. I will be honest, I cried for an hour, not knowing what I'm going to do. With my daughter then sitting next to me saying, Mama, why are you crying? I brought it up to my husband, who is about half of an essential worker as well. And there was one other daycare in town. We knew that enrollment was down, so we called them and was able to get her in there. Lauren's current, or her daycare that she started with, they have no idea when they're going to open their doors again. They have not communicated with us since they closed the doors. And childcare is so extremely important for each one of us here in our office, myself included, so I can come to work and help protect our community and represent our community. My first job as a law enforcement officer was Pequot. I've been here the entire time. I love this community. People know me. And for myself not to be able to come in to work, I would be draining, you know, my comp time, vacation time, sick time, things like that, and not be able to assist my chief with running the department in the way that it needs to be. So it means the world to me and my daughter to have her in a safe place. I'm hoping that the daycare that she's at now doesn't close their doors either. And I just want to thank you for the steps that have already been made. Because I think the steps that have already been made has been able to keep that daycare that she is in now open so I can continue to work. And I hope that maybe some more help can come. I know that you mentioned money. We do things here, you know, on a very tight budget, so I understand. But I want to be able to come to work, and I want to be able to have a safe place for my daughter. So thank you for letting me speak today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sergeant. Thank you for your work, and thanks for putting a real concrete face on how important childcare is for helping people like you do your jobs. And you made the reference to the emergency grants, and I will note that the members of this committee, Republican, Democrat, were really helpful and supportive in making that happen. I want to point out Representative Damon in particular. I was working a lot on that, but I know Representative Heintzman and others that you referenced. And so thank you so much to you for your work. And I want to then switch to our provider. And so thank you again, Sergeant. And then Ms. DeVos, I hope I'm saying your last name correctly, DeVos, perhaps, with the Little Winners Early Childhood Education Center. We'll switch to you and have you share your perspective. Again, we've got just a couple minutes for it, so please.
Sounds good. Good afternoon, Chair Pinto, members of the committee. My name is Karen DeVos. I am the owner and director of Little Learners Early Childhood Center in Ada. Little Learners is located on the same campus as a clinic, hospital, nursing home, and assisted living community. We work in partnership with Benedictine Health Systems and Essentia Health to care for the children of their employees and to provide intergenerational experiences for the seniors who call this campus their home. I just want to share a little bit about what our experience has been thus far. I work closely with the leadership teams at both facilities to ensure that we are using best practices and doing everything we can to keep the children, residents, and employees of all three entities safe. Due to this, we have implemented many new strategies for COVID-19 safety. These strategies include eliminating all contact between children and the AL, assisted living and nursing home residents. We've also increased our staffing to accommodate smaller group sizes. We've increased our staffing to help with daily cleaning and sanitizing beyond what we would normally do. We've increased our staffing to aid in screening all children as they enter our doors. And we've increased staffing to aid in ensuring that only those who are essential to the care and safety of the children we care for are allowed into our facility. Of the 48 children currently on our roster, 44 are children of essential employees. Our families, our police officers, nurses, CNAs, educators, farmers, food service workers, construction workers, bankers, and direct care providers. Most of the people who live in our small rural area are doing essential work. With the increased staffing, our payroll costs at my center have increased. However, many of the private pay families that we serve have found ways to work from and keep their children at home, which has resulted in a decrease in our weekly tuition. To make up the difference, we have applied for and been granted the Minnesota Initiative Foundation grant, which was a huge help in us making payroll last week. Yesterday, I found out that I was approved for a PPP, hopefully forgivable loan, but there has not been any real information related to when those funds will be accessible. We have also applied for the new emergency grant that is being put out through Child Care Aware. Again, we are hopeful that we'll receive some funds, but with a small amount available and the large number of providers who have applied at this time, we don't feel comfortable relying on that funding either. I will question every day if this is the right move to stay open. My two teenagers who are 18 and 16, along with obviously the rest of our team and the other teenagers who work for me, have been instrumental in keeping the doors of our center open. My two teenagers are two of the extra staff that have helped with school-age children's homework, cleaning, laundry, screening, and numerous other things involved to ensure that we are staying safe at this time. While Zooming with their teachers, keeping up with their classwork, helping their younger brother with homework, and dealing with the emotions related to the uncertainty around college, prom, and graduation. This is a family-owned business. As a business, we would probably be better off closing. My employees could collect unemployment, they could stay home with their children, and they wouldn't be stressing about what they could potentially bring home into their own environment. I would have fewer expenses, and while I wouldn't probably collect a paycheck, it's not very often right now that I'm able to anyway. And I would also know that my own children and myself and my husband would be safe and not bringing extra risks into our own home. With that being said, I feel strongly that as long as we are able, staying open and providing care to the children in our community is our responsibility. It is our responsibility to give back to a community that has given us so much. These essential employees need us. The children that we care for need something that feels normal. We will not be able to stay open unless we know that we're going to have help along the way. I can't say enough how much I appreciate the help and focus that has been put on early learning providers thus far. It is so appreciated. And I just ask that you continue to look at ways that we can help all programs stay open, whether they are for-profit, nonprofit, family providers, faith-based programs, and reopen if they've had to close so that we can all be there for the children and families we serve when this is all over. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for your work for our kids. We really appreciate it. What I'm going to do, members, just a process check here is we've got two more testifiers, and the plan is to get through each of their testimony. I think it's going to be about, we've got about 10 minutes for Ms. McCulley, I think, a former Representative Sertich has a little bit after that, and then we'll have, be able to open up to broader questions to the testifiers that we've had after Ms. Pearl. So I'd like to bring up Ms. McCulley then, if I can, and have her be unmuted. Thank you so much again to our parent and our provider. And Ms. McCulley, we'll have you start as you're able to.
Thank you very much. And I do have some slides, and I think staff has those loaded up.
Yeah, we'll get them brought up.
No worries. Thank you very much. We're all getting good at the Zoom. I appreciate the opportunity this afternoon to talk with you. I am Ann McCulley with Child Care Aware of Minnesota, and I was asked to comment on a couple of different aspects of the work that's been going on. First, to talk a little bit about what's been happening on the parent side, and I just want to echo so much of what was already shared. I was able to cut some things I was going to say because they've been said so well already by the many other testifiers. If you want to advance to the next slide, I do want to just talk a minute about the journey we have been on with first supporting parents. So you all might recall that on March 15th, the governor called for the closure of schools and pretty short order also asked schools to step in and provide childcare for school-age care children of essential workers. But there was not a systemic way in which we could provide childcare for those younger children. And one of the things that was part of that step was to ask in our particular, our system, so Child Care Aware has since, you know, for 30 years been a place that helps parents understand what the options are and help them find childcare. So we put additional people onto the phones and had them available as parents worked to try to understand what their options were going to be. And what MMB did was in a pretty quick order stand up this particular website. And if you come to the next slide, if the families tab has this map on it, they put out a survey for all childcare providers to be able to come on and update where they open, how many slots are what was their capacity. And then this was made into a searchable map that then we get the pull of this data every night in our office, and our staff can correspond with parents that are calling in. And this has been extremely helpful. One of the challenges is that, as a lot of programs, and you've heard Ms. DeVos and others say, they may close temporarily and then they open again. So the general licensing database is not the most accurate right now. This really is our best way of knowing who currently, and we encourage providers to go on and change it daily if that's what it takes, so that people can truly know where there is space available. Our Child Care Information Services team, if you want to go to the next slide, this is just a cumulative call total of what they've taken. So across the last 4 weeks, we are up to over 500 calls. And it's a real mix of and it's changed a bit as time's gone on. I would say that first week, it was a lot of parents trying to understand what the options were available at their school versus not, and a lot of triaging on our part back to those services. Then we started getting the calls that we often get, which is, I can't afford childcare. What am I going to do to support, you know, if I need to still go to childcare? As the stay-at-home order happened, then there were even more changes in what we were getting. We get a lot of calls that we send parents to Department of Health because they're asking about, is it safe to go to childcare? Should I keep my child home? And, of course, we're not the medical experts. We want them to refer to their doctor and to the Department of Health. So it's really all over the map. But we also get providers calling that same line. Even though it is set up as a parent line, we do hear from providers. And I think you've heard in all the testifiers, and I would echo this, the fear and the uncertainty and the pressure against this backdrop of all these other things going on is palpable, and we hear it every day. If you could move me on to the next slide, I do want to touch on, and you were asking earlier about the Peacetime Emergency Child Care Grants. I will echo Ms. Pearl's gratitude to have something available in the toolbox to help our child care providers, but this is, I always want to caution, I've done I don't know how many presentations. So this was signed on, you all passed it on March 25th. It was signed on, I'm looking at my calendar, the 28th, and we had the application out on April 1st. So we moved extremely quickly. But what we had to keep reminding people is that if you look at the requirements of the grant, it really is first and foremost about very focused on where are most of our essential workers, where are our highest needs in terms of essential workers. So it becomes a way, of course, to sustain childcare in the mix of that, but it is certainly not a silver bullet to support all childcare. I had said from the beginning, based on what I had seen in the MIF grant regions, that we would probably, and this is one time I was unfortunately didn't want to be right, but we did yesterday, as of the closing of the application period, hit 6,000 applications. And in the governor's supplemental budget, which was part of this discussion, I think, and this is holding true, that we'll maybe be able to fund 1,000 to 1,200, depending on the mix. So we've been trying to manage expectations. As Ms. DeVos and others pointed out, there are a lot of providers already caring for people who are considered essential. So even that does not become enough of a demarcation. I think I heard Commissioner Grove say 78% of folks working are in some kind of category of essential. So there's just so much need out there, even when we try to zero in on helping our essential workers. So, I mean, we are excited to be able to at least help those programs that will receive grants, but we know it will not be nearly enough. Next slide. I do would just want to say where this is just a little bit more detail, and again, I apologize, these are small slides, but these are all available on our website, and this is just, again, reminding folks that this is about essential workers. One important piece that with licensed family child care and centers will need to follow, and it keeps evolving, are the COVID-19 guidance for child care, what is safe during this time. And, you know, as I say, that keeps evolving, and we will be offering technical assistance through our regional staff to help people be aware of and on top of that new information. Children's Cabinet, Governor, MMB have all been putting out fantastic information with Department of Health, Department of Human Services, but it's still sometimes a challenge to reach all of our child care providers out there, some of whom don't have access right now even to internet. And if they did before, they often use the library, and the libraries are closed. So we're trying to extend the information, which is why we also did a two-week application process, I might add, even though we know there was such urgency out there, we had to make sure that we could reach our most rural and our most disconnected providers. The next map, please, or the next slide, which is a map. Just to give you one last little bit of information on the grants, because this has been coming up and I wanted to reassure people, we are using the governor's economic development regions for distribution of the funds in terms of our, how we're splitting the funds and also how we're looking at the grants. So these are, this happens to be the way our system is also structured, but before even moving forward, and you might not recall, but it's a roughly three months worth of grants is what we're estimating. It's 10 million, just shy of 10 million a month. And so before even doing any of the application, we allocated the pools into each region based on the settings that were there, meaning licensed family childcare and centers, and also the capacity, and based on a formula combining those. So there will be grants in every single governor's economic development region, but they will be focused where the need is the greatest in terms of essential workers. We also have demographic data about where the essential workers' families live and what are the commute patterns around that. So it will be within each region, but it, for instance, won't be at every county. We just can't do that. And the next slide will give you a good reason why. This is the application right now by geography. I guess we don't, maybe we have the other map here in a moment, but right now, and just to again reassure you in terms of the balance, one of the things that's in the legislation is to balance it by center. There we go, thank you. I'll back up to this one. This is a distribution for you of what it looks like right now as of Monday, I believe, anyway. And as you can see, there are requests from every county, and the density in certain counties is reflected there. So we certainly know, again, 6,000 applications out of about 9,000 programs in the state. So over 70% of our providers asking for these funds. If you did want to go to the pie chart then, my apologies. This is how it's looking split by Metro and Greater Minnesota by setting. So keeping in mind, again, it may look a little different when we look at capacity, but about 37% of the applications are coming in from Greater Minnesota and about 63% from Greater Minnesota and 37% from the Metro. And that's almost dead on to the split of what exists out there when we look at just the number of settings. So just trying to reassure that while the funds will be limited, we will be able to balance as much as possible, both because of the way the applications came in and also in the way we're allocating the funding. And I believe that might be it. That will be it. So I will stop there and be glad to stand for questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. McCauley. You didn't highlight your last slide, which I think is just sort of your standard ending, but showing the kids and what matters most, because of course, we're talking about supporting parents and they're going to work, but then there's also the key component of taking care of kids. So then our last presenter, just to wrap things up, is our former majority leader and former representative, Tony Sertich. And such an honor to have you here, sir, with the Northland Foundation. And so if we can go to you and have a final couple minutes from you, and then members will have some time for questions of all of our presenters and for broader discussion. So Representative Sertich, we'll bring you on up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tony Sertich, and I'm the president of the Northland Foundation. First, I want to start out by thanking each and every one of you for your service, especially in this unprecedented time serving the people of Minnesota. So Northland Foundation is one of six Minnesota Initiative foundations. We were founded back in the 1980s with strong support from the McKnight Foundation. The six of us are rural, regional, community foundations that serve 80 of the 87 counties of Greater Minnesota. We're independent of one another, but we serve similar purposes, especially around the issues of childcare and early childhood education. And so we've been talked about a little bit here, but I want to share with you a few different things. So the six initiative foundations all focus in some way, shape, or form on childcare and early childhood education. In Northland's perspective, we do a lot of work around childcare trainings. For the ParentAware program, we're the regional administrators of the early learning scholarships and just have been immersed in this work for over two decades. And so just as a reminder, before this pandemic struck, rural Minnesota, Greater Minnesota was already 40,000 spots short of childcare, which is really a hamper, not just on families and kiddos, but a hamper on the future of our economy in Greater Minnesota. And so once this pandemic hit and there was looking to be a legislative and executive response to this childcare crisis, Governor Walz called the six Initiative Foundation's presidents and asked if we were to be able to put together an emergency response as a bridge until you all were able to meet and develop this program and response program. And so we were able to put that together in literally days in partnership with the Minnesota Community Foundations and many of the largest philanthropic foundations in the state. We're able to get a grant from them of $600,000 and to pair that up with some of our funding and our local and regional partners to put together a program, as Ms. DeVos said, to try to be that bridge to help with payroll maybe for a couple of weeks until they could apply to the state program. And so we did that. And when we launched that program, we received in the first 24 hours, 2,750 plus applications from rural providers all across greater Minnesota. And we were talking about giving up to $3,000 for centers in greater Minnesota and $1,000 for family providers as, once again, this bridge to get to the $30 million. So over 2,750 applications. The requested funds were over $4.2 million. The unfortunate part was we only had funds available to fund about $1.3 million. So very similar to what you're seeing on this bigger, grander scale of the $30 million, the need is far, far greater. And what we've seen as some of our staff was calling these providers just to check in on them, and we made over 100 phone calls to 100 providers in northeastern Minnesota, a couple of things rang out. Most of our providers are serving somebody who is deemed an essential worker in an essential industry. 60 to 80% of our providers, roughly, just in these phone calls, are serving somebody who is an essential employee. The other thing we heard, just to kind of reiterate what happened at the beginning of this call, are some of those challenges around getting access to enough food to serve their kiddos, and also to those cleaning products, putting folks in danger, but then also getting cleaning. As you can imagine, not everybody has a Costco or a Walmart or a Target nearby them, or even a large grocery store. And so having access to many of those essential cleaning products and toilet paper is a big challenge for many in very rural, small communities, and especially for those communities that put limits on some of those things that you can purchase, rightly so, right? And so access to that is very challenging as well. And so we've been hearing, and just want to echo, we've heard that all across the state. The last few things I'll say is, you know, you all are dealing with both, I think, a short and a long-term response right now. And when we talk about what the need is, reminding you about the 40,000 that was needed beforehand, we are seeing those very providers hanging by a string. And when they shut down, if many of them do shut down, if and when this goes on longer, and even if it doesn't, I don't see all of them reopening, which is just going to exacerbate that desert that is happening. Because if you think about some of these providers, if they shut down, they will have other economic opportunities. And you all know from serving on this committee and doing this sort of work, the sustainability of the childcare sector was not strong before this crisis. And so when you're talking about these low-wage workers, and I think Representative Franson had a good point about that struggle, right, about the $600. Well, I think part of that is because it's a low-wage job, folks are taking advantage of that, but they could also move to another sector of the economy because so many of the open positions right now pay even more than working for a childcare provider. And so the economics of this is really broken. What I want to say is, yes, there is need all across a lot of sectors right now, but I would argue that there are certain sectors that are building blocks or foundational to the economies of our communities. And I would put childcare in there with broadband and a few others, because if you do not have childcare, you do not have the ability for families to work in other industries in your community. And coming from greater Minnesota, where we're looking to make sure that our youngest can either stay or come back home and attract people as we look at these demographic shifts, childcare is one of those first fundamental questions that people talk to me about, and all economic development folks talk about is, do you have childcare? Do you have broadband? How are your schools? And so I would put childcare into this category that I think is different than other economic concerns as foundational, or really fundamental to the health of our communities as a building block. And so as somebody who served over a decade ago now, and I have some of the gray hair to prove it, though I'm trying to cover it up on the Zoom call over a decade ago, you all are throwing out the rule book by having this hearing the way you did. This was unheard of when I served in the legislature. So folks are throwing out rule books left and right, and I would encourage you to do the same thing. because, as I said, the sustainability of childcare sector was in doubt before this. You're not going to be able to nibble around the edges. And that's hard to hear because there's a lot of challenges right now. But for the health of our communities, not just for the health of the families and kiddos, but for the health and well-being of our communities all across Minnesota, you will need to do something different. The fundamentals, the sustainability of the childcare sector will need to radically change. And if not now in this crisis, when are you going to be able to do that? So thank you for what you've done. And because there is no selfishness in the foundation, because we are not a childcare provider, I will just be bold and say $30 million was not enough. And I know that that's what you could do at that time, but that's just the reality of how we're living. And if we shortchange our childcare response as a state, as a people, and there's no silver bullet, but if we shortchange it, we're going to shortchange our ability to come out of this pandemic and grow as a Minnesota economy. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you so much, Representative Sertich. Thank you for the testimony and for your work. And I'm actually really embarrassed not to have thanked publicly the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, as you referenced, the Minnesota philanthropic community, Think Small, which really did step in before we did and provided that bridge to the $30 million. In my view, too, yeah, we need so much more. But the work that you all did, you and so many others, we're really, really grateful as a state, because that was a case of private philanthropic groups coming together and doing what they could at that moment to bridge that. So thank you and so much, and thanks so much to them. So members, we're going to move to questions, and Representative Sertich, please stick around for that as well. I know Ms. McCulley will and others. Representative Damuth is our first was the first person, so let's bring her up. And I think members, we're going to be unmuting all of you so we can have a discussion. I'd ask you to please keep your microphones on mute until you're going to be speaking, just to make things easier. So Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the testimony that we've heard today. And Mr. Chair, as you remember, as we had a chance to work on that $30 million, it was a long process. Whether or not it was going to be enough, it's what we could do. And I'm glad that we were able to get that through. We all know the importance of childcare quality, so we can go and do what we need to do to make sure our kids are taken care of. I know, just remembering back to some of those the meetings, we had heard that there was going to be about 1,300 providers that were positioned to start taking care of our workers in the most critical care. And so now to hear that there were 6,000 applications is quite surprising. So maybe my question is for Ms. McCulley, and maybe it was in your presentation, which I appreciate very much, but simple question. Do you have a breakdown of those 6,000 applications between how many might have been center-based and how many were family-based?
Ms.
Yes,
McCulley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Damuth, we'll have that shortly, but last I was able to look, and again, the applications just closed last night, so we are crunching the numbers. There are staff looking at that right now, but it was mirroring very closely what the population is in each region, at least. So statewide, it might, you know, I haven't looked at it statewide, but I know by region, we were tracking that pretty closely, because again, there is an expectation in the legislation that I believe that it reads, to the extent practical, we're going to balance that. So, you know, someplace like way up in northwestern Minnesota region one, it's almost exclusively family child care. And so that's where most of the applications came from. In other regions where it's more balanced, it was more balanced. So I think you will see both that split between metro and rural, and also that split between family child care and center tracks pretty closely with who's out there in the first place.
Representative Damuth.
Nothing further. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sure. So, Representative Katiza Watoon is up next. Representative Katiza Watoon, when you're...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unmuted myself. Yeah, and I just wanted to express my gratitude to all the testifiers today. Our parent who was able to come and share some of her struggles with us, provider kind of speaking on behalf of so many providers, as we know, all across the state. These are extraordinary times, and I think that you touched on it, Mr. Chair, early on in today's meeting, that this before the pandemic, we were in a very precarious situation in childcare, and kind of the testimony that we've heard today only kind of solidifies that. But in so many cases, early childhood educators and caregivers are the linchpin that allow our families and our economy to function. But still, so many of our district preschool teachers are working without contract, and in-home and center-based providers are struggling with just how to cover these daily overhead costs. while keeping their staff and children that they're caring for safe. I'm kind of considering just the strange times that we're living in and in what may put a finer point on how our technological and yet very basic lives are kind of colliding during the pandemic as we're staying at home and self-quarantining and self-isolating. I've read a number of articles online about parenthood, smiled at some cartoons or memes that are trying to capture just how we're all feeling, and connected with strangers and neighbors via social media. One of the memes that I saw had said, when do we find out who the kids' teacher is next year? I hope it's not me. And I think that is certainly how at least some of the parents in my circle are feeling, that we're balancing work and family life in addition to becoming teachers and full-time caregivers as well, if that wasn't our situation previously. And one of the cartoons that I saw described the inner contemplation of a man who's sitting there and thinking of all these essential workers that he depends on just so that he's able to self-isolate. It was in the comment section of this cartoon that a local childcare provider had noted those who work in early care and learning are often left off this list. And so they're very seldom included on the list of those who are helping to make our world go around right now. And I think that it's so important that all of us who are here and hearing the stories and the testimony of families and providers, experts in the industry, we're trying to shine a light on how one of our most critical societal industries had reached a breaking point even before the unique challenges caused by this global pandemic. And I just want to say to our providers, your work is so important. You are essential. I want to say to our parents, you're doing the best you can. Your work is important and essential. And we, parents and employers and community members, legislators, are so grateful. And we are here to help. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Witun. Thank you. And so moving to Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I found interesting, I think I heard this correctly. So if I recall, the Children's Cabinet Survey had about 1,300 interested providers when the $30 million was approved by the legislature. But there was about 6,000 applications for funding, which is amazing. So I'm just wondering what happened. Did the Children's Cabinet miscalculate the potential participation? Because if so, if we would have taken, you know, we could have taken a different approach to the funding if we had more of an accurate projection. So I'm just wondering what went wrong here.
Well, so
if I recall, when we were sitting in committee, we were like, this is kind of like, we had that overview and it was like 1,300 or so people that we found that would participate in this program, right? And okay, Ms. McCulley.
Ms. McCulley, why don't you go, and then I've got a couple thoughts as I was helping to put the grant program together to propose it to colleagues. But Ms. McCulley, give us some chance to share.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, I'll defer to you and some of the, I was not involved in the inner conversations, but I will say that a couple of things. Number one, we've had some confusion about people thinking that being in the survey meant you're applying for the grant, and those are two very different things. That's just one piece I want to say. The other is that there is the opportunity if someone at, I guess the other thing I would say is that it's changing daily. So from the time those numbers were likely looked at, then when we went to the stay-at-home order, we had more providers who suddenly had capacity because people pulled their kids and took them home. So those numbers are changing. In fact, we went through this, the application process, people wanted to call and constantly update their application, and we finally had to say it's a point in time, even in these 2 weeks. And then the other thing I would say is the application does allow people who had closed temporarily to open if they can take more essential workers. So there's multiple reasons why the application pool might look different than what was in the survey initially, and then I'll just defer to whatever else you might have in terms of that history.
Well, I'll just note, and this is probably good context too for members of the public who are watching, that there's about 10,000 providers in the state. So And the concern was that we have the industry be available for care of essential workers. So even if we had only 1,300, you'd know that's only 10% of the industry. So right there, it's a, I mean, I think to a certain extent, we're stuck a little bit by sort of what, how much we're willing to fund. You know, we said we're going to put in 30 million. If we'd known there's 6,000 providers, 6,000 applicants, I don't know if that would have necessarily, I certainly would have supported spending more. I don't know. And also I'll say if others want to say right now they want to spend, they want to spend more, that's great. And a reminder too, that the survey that went out, of course, who knows? And I think, efforts are made to get out in front of as many providers as possible. I'm not sure though that the survey said, if there were a grant program, would you be willing? The question is, would you be willing? And presumably for some providers, they say, I can't afford to do it right now. But if there was some states, if there was some support to be able to care for children like Lauren, Sergeant Peterson's daughter, well, then I could. So I think it's a little bit, that's where it's a little bit challenging with comparing the 1,300 who said, yeah, we're willing to provide with no support in a survey versus the applicants to the to this funding that we passed. But Representative Franson, we'll send it back to you.
I had to unmute myself. Okay. No, that's good. I just was kind of curious there because, like I said, we could have probably gone, but hindsight is 2020. So,
well, Representative Franson, if the thinking is that we maybe could have gone higher a few weeks ago, we could do that now. Just saying, we could talk. I'd be happy to, we can continue the discussion. What I'm hearing so far is that there's a significant danger that without support that we will in fact lose the industry, and then we'll be down to zero. So that's a challenge. But I'll let you go back. I can tell you want to. Yeah, Representative Franson, please.
Well, I'm wondering too if private industry can kind of help out as well to support foundations, right? In regards
Please continue.
Some scholarship funding of some sort or hazard pay.
And Representative Franson, I think
it's in the best interest of these of industry that's available, that's working, that they continue to keep a workforce right now. So they would also have some skin in the game in making sure that the providers are paid adequately right now.
And I think Representative Franson, we sort of see a little bit in what was described from the Northland Foundation, that even with lots and lots of work, you know, they can raise $1 million. And I kind of know there was a huge amount of work to get that $1 million raised. The state can work at a scale, and there's not private industry that would help provide care for Sergeant Peterson's daughter, right? Because she's working for the police department. Just doesn't, challenging. But I know Representative Heintzman is next on the list. We'll move to him, and then we can keep going back as well. So Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That line of questioning actually kind of got the juices flowing a little bit, and I'm wondering if maybe Ms. McCauley could help me out a little bit. In the days going forward, probably years, I'm assuming, but well, hopefully not that long, hopefully months. Are we ever going to have some hard numbers kind of going through those that received a grant to give us an idea how many families were served? We're making obviously a significant investment. Just wondering if there's going to be some post-event numbers that'll be available to figure out how those resources were utilized and the efficiency of what we're doing.
Ms. McCauley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, absolutely. We are setting a few things in motion. As I mentioned, we'll have some follow-up technical assistance that we will be giving to get better information from each of the grantees. Each grantee is going to be followed up with to get some of those questions answered about current capacity, how many children do come to them in addition to the children they're already serving who are essential workers. A reminder that this is a multi-month application process, so these are monthly grants. So in order to trigger the next month, there'll have to be another application. So that's another place where we can gather data on what the picture has been. We'll have the raw data of how many applications we received, how many were funded by region, by setting. I think there's several data points already that we'll be able to glean initially, and then through this both follow-up process and multi-month application process, we will have additional data, yes.
Representative Heintzman, that all?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So yeah. I guess I'll have one quick follow-up for Ms. McCauley, and that would be more specifically to the question of families that were served. I didn't hear that in her comments. And then, Mr. Chair, for you specifically, I'm wondering a number of other committees. I'll give you an example: the Environment and Natural Resources Committee and the Waters Committee have been looped in to a weekly meeting with the commissioner at MPCA. I'm wondering if you and the lead on this committee or maybe other committees relative to the issues that we're dealing with, I think it's a very serious issue. Are you being looped in on those kind of conversations with the commissioner, or are you guys outside of that discussion?
Let me think. Why don't we have Ms. McCauley answer, and then I'll answer your second question. I just want to make sure we get to both of them. So Ms. McCauley first, then I'll get to the second part.
Sure. Representative Pinto, Representative Heitzman. Yes, I'm sorry if I said, I think I used the term capacity. I'm talking lingo now, but one of the things we'll be gathering is not only how many children during that month are you serving who are already in your care who are essential workers, but did you take and receive additional families who were essential workers, and heavy emphasis on the tier one in particular, so hospitals, correctional facilities, nursing homes, that kind of thing, but also the tier two essential workers.
Okay. And then Representative Heitzman, to your other question then, no, there's not a regular, I'm not having a regular meeting with anyone myself, nor is there a larger group in this area, but I really like that idea. I guess I'll have to find out from Environment, Natural Resources and Waters if it's the entire membership of the committee that the meeting with the commissioner. I need to look into that because I could see there might be some challenges with that. But happy to meet with a smaller group, or I mean, we can talk about that. But no, that's not happening. But I really like that idea, and I think that makes a lot of sense.
Well, so, yeah. I can clarify, Mr. Chair. I can clarify. You know, it's very Please. Specifically been the lead on the committees as well as the chair. And that weekly phone call with the commissioner has been really helpful, and to be able to get that feedback from the commissioner. So I hope that other committees are being able to visit with the commissioner in their subject areas.
Well, I will publicly and gladly invite Lead Franson to do that with me, and that would be great. And we can talk about it separately. But yeah, no, I'd be delighted to do that. So yeah, no, thank you for that idea. Other members, I'm looking to see if I've got anyone else on the list here, and I don't know that I do, but I'll give folks another minute to see if they have something. I guess as you're considering that, I'll just ask Ms. McCauley. It seems like there's a bit of a tension in terms of, I mean, it sounds like you're likely to be issuing grants for about the number that we had in mind. I think you said something like 1,200 most likely. It sounds like those will be coming out in the next few days. We know that there were so many more applications. I suppose the challenge is if you issued many more grants, then the money would run out that much faster versus having it last for a couple months with monthly grants. How are you thinking about that tension? Because it kind of seems like it's a lose-lose either way. I mean, the challenge is, you know, either the money runs out real quickly if you do a larger number of grants, but if you only have it at 1,200, we know there's all that need, then I get worried that, you know, that we aren't even necessarily meeting the need. So how are you thinking about that?
Sure. Representative Pinto, thank you. Yes, it is a huge tension, and I think it's a fine line between having enough to sustain the programs. So keeping in mind that not only do childcare programs run on such a thin margin as we've talked about, but the extra efforts they need to make in terms of cleaning and processes that they have to follow to be in guidance, in line with the guidance, the fact that they'll have to take fewer children in order to maintain the safe group sizes, all of that has to come into play here. And so it's finding that balance between how much we'll keep the doors open enough to make sure, again, at the end of the day, it's about our essential workers having a place to be that can be relied upon during the course of the peacetime emergency. They're called peacetime emergency grants to remind us that it's to follow that timeline. And of course, probably the biggest challenge that we all have is no crystal ball to know how long that is meant to last. And so we didn't want to make it a one-time competitive. We do a lot of regional grants that are one-time. We do a lot of scholarships and grants like the retained grants. Those are very different than this. We didn't want to just fund one pool and then another pool. It really needs to be that if you've got those children in your care, you've got some ability to count on that for the what might be multiple months that this will last. So the one thing we I may not have mentioned that we are trying to do is keep a little bit of the pool off to the side, if you will. And there's also some language in the grant agreement that says we might revisit your amount because, and heaven forbid we would have this in Minnesota, but if we do end up with a hotspot or an area where there is a sudden outbreak and we need to ramp up childcare, we want to have the ability to redirect or to have some funds in the first place to give to supplement the childcare in a particular community that may not initially have been funded. So it's a extremely careful line we try to walk and it's a choice and in some ways driven, of course, by the legislation that laid out some of the groundwork, but there's the approach of giving everybody a little bit or giving fewer people enough to sustain. And I think this grant and the legislation erred on the side of let's make sure we have a solid number of people that we can sustain.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. We do need to sort of bring things to a wrap, and I'm not seeing more questions as well, but I know that the other committee, we're going to have to get things set up for House Public Information. I want to thank all of our testifiers, and certainly members can continue to be in touch with them. But I think this has been a really useful conversation and discussion. We do not know our hearing time next week because, again, as I referenced, there's this challenge of only having two committees can meet at a time, and there's a lot going on. So we'll get that information as soon as we can. What I do know is that we'll want to direct our attention to the issue of knowing that there's actually federal funding that's been sitting in a bank for a while that can go to our child care assistance program. We need to adjust rates to be in federal compliance in order to access those funds in order to avoid receiving a penalty. That it seems to me anyway is an important thing for us to examine. And so expect that to be the next thing that we'll look at in our next hearing as well. So with that, I will thank our testifiers and our members, and we'll get things cleared out for the next committee coming in. But we know that the child care is absolutely the backbone of all the other essential work that's being done. And so I appreciate our focus on it. Let's continue the conversation about what we can do to support it, make sure that we don't lose it. Thanks so much again, everybody. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.